Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at how Tulsa is reducing its chronically homeless population. The answer, as it turns out, is as simple as it is seemingly far-fetched. It's simply to give this population a home with no conditions other than to pay something in rent and be a good tenant. The Housing First program here in Tulsa works in exactly that way. As it turns out, giving an apartment to a chronically homeless person is far cheaper to the community than the services need to care for that person on the streets. And the better news is once a person has stable housing, they will get help for their disabilities, mental health, and substance abuse issues, and move into the general community, back to being a wage earner and a taxpayer. I'm joined today by two specialists from the Mental Health Association in Tulsa, Mike Bros, the executive director, Greg Shin, the associate director. The Mental Health Association is working to end chronic homelessness in Tulsa. The numbers are less than 100 now on the streets, and they have a plan to actually get those last 100 into housing in the next couple of years. Mike Bros, Greg Shin joins us to talk about Housing First here in Tulsa. Mike and Greg, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
We're glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
The Mental Health Association of Tulsa is working to end chronic homelessness, and you've got over, what, 400 units, 500 units now?
Actually, 650.
650 today.
Right.
Now, you've set these up for the chronic homeless. How do we define chronic homeless versus homeless? Is there a difference?
Well, there is, and usually when we use the term chronic homeless, we're referencing the HUD Housing Urban Development definition, which is continuously homeless for 1 year or four times in the previous 3 years. So they have a very tight definition, which there's a lot of folks that around the country who struggle with that definition, but that is their point of reference, and at least it keeps everybody in the country in terms of counting and keeping track of what that number is. It does give us all a reference point.
And on top of that, you have to have a documented, diagnosable disability, physical disability, a mental illness, and or co-occurring substance abuse disorder, whatever combination thereof, but it's the length of time qualifications plus the disability.
And generally, if it's economic distress, you're not homeless for that long for the most part?
Well, we do a better job with people. The majority of the people who become homeless lose their housing. Of course, most people turn to family and friends when that happens. And then there's folks that
don't have that support.
That's not an option, or it's that option's run out, so they turn to the shelter system. Most of those folks, actually, their homelessness ends relatively in a short period of time, and many of those folks never return to homeless again, but it's those people who day after day after day live in the shelters, live on the streets, then eventually they become habituated to the streets. And they start into that chronic homeless lifestyle. That's what we've got to try to end.
Yeah, and traditionally, how have communities around the country and here in Tulsa dealt with the chronic homeless? Is it a matter of sheltering them? Is it a matter of incarcerating them? I know it's probably a mixture of both.
Well, that's a byproduct. Incarceration, institutionalization of the chronically homeless is a byproduct of the lack of a community plan on how to address the situation. When shelters were first being created, when deinstitutionalization was taking place, the closing of the state psychiatric hospitals, like Eastern State in Veneta, and that was taking place across the country in the 70s and 80s, and many of those people had no safety net. There was no supportive housing for those individuals to move to, and they fell through the cracks to the bottom, became homeless. You can actually still find some of those people on the streets that have been in and out and in and out of institutions and so forth. And the lack of a plan actually, you know, it was by default that they ended up in shelters for very long periods of time, cycling through incarceration and rehospitalization and so forth, stuck in this vicious cycle of homelessness that was intractable for them.
In fact, I've seen statistics lately which suggest that this is one of the biggest growth in prison populations and jail populations is people who, because of lack of medication, are acting out and in turn being incarcerated for things really shouldn't be in jail for.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but my entire professional career, we've watched and seen that again. When Eastern State or the state institutions were to close, that the money was to follow them and back into the community, that money that was freed up, and it's actually we moved over to a different type of institution, a prison. And so a lot of those people, because they weren't as bad as conditions or the situation was to have people institutionalized, well, now many of them are in fact incarcerated. But what we're trying to do here, we're bucking that trend, and we're trying to develop other alternatives.
And a big part of that is getting these folks off the street into housing. And you know, you have 600 plus units here in the city.
Scattered all around.
Yeah.
Touch 14 different neighborhoods. They're all over. And, it's really about now the philosophy that's considered the best practice around the country is called housing first. And the whole idea that, I always tell people Maslow's need hierarchy.
Yeah.
What's the bottom rung?
Got to have a
safety,
roof over the head.
Shelter, security, and those people don't have that. So how could they possibly, could we expect them to then begin to manage their lives effectively? But if we can get them into housing, get them in there, and then wrap services around them. So that's where the term housing first comes from.
Now, I know that getting this approach accepted is sort of, it was a bit of a learning curve, and really the most telling statistics was to look at how you're housing the chronically homeless without the housing element and with it, because even though they're probably say you're going to give housing away, it's cheaper.
Yes, it is.
It's cheaper for taxpayers. It's cheaper for every sort of services, and I think that sort of escalates along the way.
Yes, there's been many studies done across the country now that document the fact that affordable housing and what's called permanent supportive housing, which is the housing and the support services that go with it, is actually many times cheaper than allowing people to cycle through incarceration and shelter stays and emergency transports and, many medical and psychiatric hospitalizations that really the taxpayers are footing the bill for all of that and using emergency health care as primary care and so forth. So the housing is really a lot cheaper. In Tulsa, it's a minimum of $10,000 a year less to have somebody in housing, sometimes as much as $30,000 or $40,000 a year less per person to have somebody in the permanent supportive housing than on the streets and in the shelters.
Now, Michael, I remember when you were first getting your first unit up over at 244 in Yale, there was lots of neighborhood opposition. They really didn't understand the concept. They really didn't understand. How has that worked out?
Well, it's interesting because that actually was not our first housing program. We had actually been developing housing, buying properties very quietly. People can live there by right, and we would buy a property, and actually we own a property right across the street from the University of Tulsa, and nobody said anything, and it was very quiet. The difference between the what's now called the Yale Avenue Apartments at Admiral and Yale was because the Tulsa Housing Authority was our partner. And that required by law, since they were involved, we had to have a public hearing.
Uh-huh.
And so that created this initial firestorm. But it's been really amazing. Rather than criticize those people, we said, it's our job to educate them. And so we said, look, if you're going to criticize what we're doing, that's fine. But at least take the time to come out for an hour and look and drive. Let us drive you around, show you, introduce you to the people that we're talking about, let you meet them, talk to them, what have you. And then after we're done with that, if you want to criticize us, that's okay. And many, many people did take us up on our offer and came out. We gave literally hundreds of tours. We still give tours. And we really began to turn it around. And I got to give the faith community a lot of credit. We really turned to the faith communities in those neighborhoods, and the faith communities really stepped up. And I give them credit for turning the tide in those neighborhoods. Now we have a wonderful relationship with those neighborhoods.
Well, let's talk about how the system works. You identify somebody who's chronically homeless. You have an open bed. How does the process work, Greg?
Well, we have multiple outreach teams. In the city. There's some faith-based outreach teams. There's the outreach from the Veterans Administration, because a large number of veterans are homeless and chronically homeless across the country. And we have a homeless outreach team that is funded through a grant that the Mental Health Association has from Department of Housing and Urban Development. And we contract that grant out to Family and Children's Services here locally, which is a mental health provider. And they do street outreach for the homeless people with mental illnesses and co-occurring disorders, and identify them and engage them. And all of those outreach teams then refer back to the housing. And sometimes we have waiting lists. You know, they can be long even, because we're full all the time. But we identify those people and begin the engagement process. And so when a unit is open, we move them in as quickly as we can.
Is it a negotiation to get these, oftentimes these chronically homeless, to come in off the street?
It can be at times. There might be resistance from the person, but the resistance from the people that are on the street is a little bit of a myth. There is some of that. I actually used to do street outreach in New York City, and I did encounter some of that. But for the most part, if you can remove the barriers to getting into the housing, like let's say somebody still has an outstanding fine, or they have bad credit history, they have a felony, they don't qualify for Section 8 or public housing, they don't want to stop drinking, they have a dog, they have a significant other that they can't be legally on a lease. There's all kinds of things and barriers. So the idea with Housing First is remove those barriers, give them access to the housing, meet the person where they're at, and then continue to engage them and try to wrap all those things that they need around them and move towards a more positive and sustainable lifestyle.
So once they're in the housing, then you begin working, okay, are you, if you have a mental illness, for example, are you getting your meds? Do you have a place to get your meds? Are you taking your meds? If you have a substance abuse problem, you know, what are you doing about this?
That's
is there anything
right.
we can help to alleviate this?
We know where they're at. They're uh-huh. in their apartments. And so our provider partners, Family and Children's Services, Counseling Recovery Services, can begin to really engage these people as well as our staff do, and begin to address and tackle those particular issues and begin to connect them up with the services that we have in our community much more effectively. So that's where it becomes so much more. All of our services that the community gives to and supports through their United Way dollars and other private gifts, those services through this become much more efficient, much more effective by having the person actually in that housing first. And so that makes it work much better.
And I'm assuming that the service nodes are there on site?
They are in the community. They can come to the site.
Uh-huh.
That's why it's because it's this is strictly housing. I mean, it sounds kind of base, but the Mental Health Association, basically, we're a landlord.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why people can live there in those neighborhoods by right. So there's no program on site. But just like if I'm coming out of hospitalization, a home health nurse can come to my house. A physical therapist can come to my house. I can have services delivered there as I need to. That happens all the time in the community. No different from these individuals. But many of these people, they get on the bus. Some of them have their own cars. They go to the services where they're at. The more they stabilize, the more they begin to reintegrate back in the community, they begin to look just like everybody else and just go about their business.
It's important, though, to understand that access to the housing is not contingent upon accepting those services.
Right.
That is the linchpin of Housing First. If you require somebody to be sober, if you require somebody to have an income, if you require somebody to have all of these areas of their life in order, they will remain homeless longer and longer and longer. Which I ran a shelter in New York City for 8 years. In the financial district, and people stayed in our shelter for years because the housing required them to be housing ready before they moved in. And Samson Barris with Pathways to Housing did this research that showed if you just put them into the housing, regardless of whether they're still psychotic or using drugs or alcohol or have an income or not or whatever, a year later, 80% of those people are still housed. Our statistics over 15 to 20 years now bears that out, that using Housing First, a year later, 80% or more of the population is still housed, and they're getting the services in the end, by the way.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking. I would think there's like it's a peer situation, isn't it? I mean, if all your neighbors are functioning and you realize you're not functioning, you know, as well as you should be, perhaps it's time to get help. I mean, it's sort of a self-realization rather than a requirement.
Yeah, the whole peer-to-peer thing. I mean, the neighbors, also that, our most recent numbers, our own self-report of our own employees, 55% of our employees of the Mental Health Association live in recovery from a serious mental illness, and 45% of them have been homeless who work for us now, what have you. And so there is a lot of peer-to-peer interaction. Look, I've been there. And that's a very powerful strategy that's not only going on here in Tulsa and around the state, but all over the country, where people who have actually lived this as a part of their recovery, they get employed or they volunteer or whatever, and it's a lot of peer-to-peer interaction that you speak of.
Mike Brose is my guest. He's the executive director of the Mental Health Association in Tulsa. Greg Shin is the associate director. And they're working to end chronic homelessness in Tulsa. 650 units here housing the chronically homeless. Now, I asked about setbacks earlier, but what has been affirmed by what you've been doing? Are you seeing people who come to these units spend a little bit of time, and pretty soon they're building up credit? They're able to get their own apartments, perhaps even houses themselves. Are they and moving back into the community?
Yeah, I mean, we could sit here and tell you stories for hours. One recent one right now is a veteran who actually started in one of our housing locations, and this is not an anomaly. This happens sometimes. Is that when they come in, they don't do so well and they struggle. And this particular guy, he fell out of the housing after not wanting to be a very good tenant and neighbor. It wasn't really so much about his mental illness or some of those things. He just, you know, he was not a very good neighbor, and I think he had some things to learn about what it meant to have a lease and be in an apartment and be a good neighbor. Well, he actually removed himself and gave up his apartment, came back to us, started over again at Yale Apartments in our Safe Haven program, and has worked his way back in and integrated with the services from the VA, has done a lot of community volunteering, gotten involved in a lot of different support groups. And last week, he moved out into a 3-bedroom condo here off of 15th Street in Tulsa. I mean, and bought a car, and he's got his disability income established through the VA now. And it's phenomenal, the story of recovery that you see over and over and over again. So he's still connected to his support network, but he doesn't need to live in our supported housing anymore, and that opened up a unit for another person down at the shelter.
What is the rate? I'm sure you're tracking, you know, the success rate and.
Yeah, we have numbers going back 20 years, and across the board, our success rate is about 80%. But I think embedded in that number also is, and Greg alluded to this, is that one of the things that separates us from, a private landlord, which, by the way, we work with many private landlords in the community who do a great job in working with us and the people we serve. But one of the things that we refer to ourselves as a benevolent landlord, and what that means is that to end chronic homelessness in Tulsa or anywhere, you have to be willing to give people a second chance. And Greg alluded to this individual, this veteran, who it didn't work the first time. I talked to a young guy yesterday. He was he just couldn't manage himself, became just too difficult. We had to evict him, but I talked to him. I said, look, when you're ready, let us know. Let's start over. And that's what separates us. A private landlord will rarely ever give another person a second chance if they have to evict them. We have a saying around our office that everybody deserves a second chance, even if it's their fourth or fifth second chance. And we all need a second chance.
Yeah. Now, this sounds like it works differently from some of the other models I've heard, which, as you mentioned, do have barriers. For example, I know there's some out in L.A. where a lot of times that mental health element is embedded right in the apartment complex. And that would think that'd be a barrier. But if you're not ready to get treatment or you're not ready to to commit that keeps you out and keeps you on the streets.
That's what we call the functional separation of housing and services. Your lease and your ability to be a tenant in an apartment, pay your rent, not disturb the quiet enjoyment of the other tenants in the building is completely separate from whether you have services for mental illness or substance abuse disorder, for instance. So you can live there whether you have the services or not. So they're voluntary. But we hope that people will accept those services that facilitate their recovery. But I think that one of the other very unique things about what we've done here in Tulsa is that we are both the owner and the operator. We own every one of these properties. We own them debt-free with money that we raise through a private and public partnership model. And so that makes us unique even to the operators of other permanent supportive housing models across the country. And since we are the landlord and we are a property management company with a leasing department and a maintenance department and all and so forth, we have the flexibility, we have the leverage to make those decisions because we're the owner. We're not beholden to the decisions of another landlord, which is the way that a lot of communities do it. And I'm not saying that there's a right or a wrong way, but our model is somewhat unique and we are in the power seat determining that on a case-by-case basis. So I think that we have proven it's extremely effective. And as a matter of fact, on a national level, we've gotten a lot of notice in the last couple of years regarding the way that we've done this.
Now, I want to stop you. And I heard something, Greg, which I was, this may be a dumb question, but Are your tenants paying rent? All
yes.
Of your tenants?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think
is it very nominal, or I mean, because the assumption is that if you're homeless, you really don't have a whole lot of money at your disposal.
We do have programs in our what we call our safe haven units, where we have budgeted in where people, if they don't have an income, it doesn't become, or our transitional living program called Walker Hall, where if people don't have an income, that isn't a barrier, but we want to help people and work with people to establish an income source as quickly as possible. And as Greg referred to, owning our properties debt-free without having to pay a debt, that allows us to keep our rents lower.
But there is definitely a rent because it's about getting you back into the system.
Not more than 30% of their monthly income, mm-hmm. whatever that may be. And sometimes that's way below the market. But what we do is we help people live side by side and integrate into the community with market rate payers. So if we buy, for instance, a 40-unit apartment complex, 20 of those units will be dedicated to people that are formerly homeless with mental illnesses and co-occurring disorders, substance abuse, physical disabilities, and so forth. And the other half of the tenants in that building will be market rate payers, and we make a profit on those market rate payers. The market rate payers, the profit helps sustain all of the staffing positions and goes back into the operations and helps subsidize the other units so that we can continue to offer at way below the market those units to the people that have been homeless.
My guests today, Greg Shin and Mike Bros of the Mental Health Association in Tulsa, who are working to end chronic homelessness in Tulsa. They have this new model of Housing First. And you're probably going to hear more about it coming up next month at the Zero Mental Health Symposium. As you mentioned, you're getting a lot of positive press. So 80% success rate, that's really great. What happens after they leave the Housing First housing, if they reintegrate into the community? Is there a way of, I assume they have support networks in place at this point, but I assume that the community is actively engaging with this individual to make sure, say, if, say, they're bipolar, that they're taking their medication on a regular basis, and checking in with them. Is there a system of follow-up once they leave this housing?
Yeah, again, as Greg said, you know, people don't have to accept services, and he described that in terms of that separation of the housing from the services. But as they accept services, what have you, they are continually engaged and in various programs and services that are provided by what we would call mental health or substance abuse providers in the community. And you know, again, I think it's important to note that our housing is called permanent supported, which people can live there as long as they want. And we have some people, I mean, I know a guy who's lived in the apartment 15 at one of our apartments for, he told me the other day he'd been there 17 years in that little efficiency apartment. Mm-hmm. You know, we have other people that say, wow, you know, I'm in this safe haven. I'm getting on my feet now. It sure is small. I sure would love to have a little more space. And we say, good, let's take a look around, see what else is out there in the community. And as Greg said, as people continue to move up, and these individuals are no different from you or I. They want more space. They like to live in a little nicer neighborhood, maybe, what have you. It's just human nature, so we try to facilitate that, and then that unit then is available for somebody else.
Well, let's talk about the effects on the streets. Are we starting to see an effect on the street among the chronically homeless? Are we seeing far fewer?
Well, I think that the answer to that is yes. Of course, the economy was very bad there, and it's still in a slow recovery mode, but getting better. But as a matter of fact, Tulsa is one of the communities in the country that is leading the way in the reduction of chronic homelessness. And in the last point-in-time count conducted in January of this year, and the point-in-time count is an annual count across the country that's mandated by HUD, and every community does it, we counted 63 chronically homeless individuals on the streets and in the shelters, which does not include the people that live in safe haven. So we subtract the people that live in the safe haven. And so 63, and we've been at well below 100 now for the last 3 to 4 years, and we're kind of maintaining this very low number. But we have an interesting new program called A Way Home for Tulsa, which is organizing the social service delivery system, the shelter operators, the housing providers, to prioritize the remaining individuals by name on a list. We have a top 100 long-term stayers list, and we're going to methodically assign each of those individuals to a case manager and house them and try to get to zero here in the next couple of years. So that's our community plan. We have the housing, and we're going to try to house every one of these individuals, whatever the barrier they have, we're going to try to remove it and get them into housing.
That's pretty amazing, less than 100. I think most people would think that there are far more.
Oh, I've done my own little surveys with people and said, yeah, how many homeless do you think we have in Tulsa? And they'll say, oh, 5,000, 1,000, you know. It's actually, now there are more you know, outside the chronic homeless population, there are more homeless who turn to the shelter than that, what that number is. But yeah, again, through rapid rehousing, some of the other initiatives that have gone on, we're trying to really address that also. And so we are seeing that number drop down in Tulsa. And Greg didn't mention, but what's called the 100,000 Home Campaign, which is a campaign to create 100,000 homes for this population around the country, who they keep tabs on the numbers in 140 some cities around the country, and these cities turn their numbers in, and we were just recently, of course, named number two in the country in terms of our rate of moving people from chronic homelessness into housing, number two in the country. So we were very proud of that.
It sounds like, though, this last 100 are the ones that you're going to probably spend a lot more time and effort.
And if we don't get them into housing, they're going to continue to be a strain on the social service delivery, you know, the emergency rooms and incarceration. So yes, the chronic homeless numbers are low now, but those are the highest end users of the entire system and by far the most expensive people that are out there to allow to remain homeless. And it's a quality of life issue for the community. You know, Tulsa is a very rich community in a lot of ways, and this is a problem that we can solve. And we have a method with the Building Tulsa Building Lives campaign, our portfolio of affordable housing, and A Way Home for Tulsa on the social service delivery side. We have a very, very methodical plan to zero out that number.
That's a great story for our community. Mike and Greg, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Mike Brose and Greg Shin of the Mental Health Association in Tulsa speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. To learn more about Housing First and their upcoming Zero Mental Health Symposium, visit mhat.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.